This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie back from her little jaunt in Hong Kong. How are you, Tobias?
Yeah, good, good. Good to have you back.
Yeah, it seemed like a long time ago. I was just saying to Tobias that the weird thing about Melbourne, I went to Hong Kong for a week and my sinuses cleared up, came back to Melbourne, they're completely blocked again. So, hooray.
Those cursed ornamental pears.
Exactly. Lovely day outside. Interesting weather throughout the week, of course. We had the wild gales. And if you were just caught up with Stick Together, you would have heard that there's more on the way.
Yeah, lots of... I mean, we saw the damage that was done here. Two friends were on the Frankston Pier. They passed away, swallowed by the swells. And in New Zealand, there was quite shocking videos of people getting blown into oncoming traffic. That's how strong the force was. They are okay. They didn't get hit by the oncoming traffic, but still very dangerous stuff as branches snap and people die.
Yeah, the weather can kill you and nature doesn't care.
Yeah, well, it's not nature's fault, huh? When
no,
Woodside
that's what
opens up new facilities.
And say that it's absolutely essential for the economy. Before we get on to that, let's go back to Sunday and the violence expressed by the police against anti-fascist people rallying against the collection of a motley crew, I'll have to say, of what do they call themselves?
The March for Australia.
Yes.
Who's they've just announced that career racist and Zionist shill from the UK, Tommy Robinson, is set to appear in some form or another at a rally at their next rally in November. So I sincerely doubt that he will get let through customs if they're not letting right-wing agitator Candace Owens through. But stranger things have happened when the Zionist lobby is involved. However, on Sunday, saw them at probably some of the most reduced capacity they've been so far. So in a movement that started with, we can say, tens of thousands on the street in August 31st.
Across the country.
Across the country as well. Here, by, 3 months later, not even, they're down to 2,000 people due to internal squabbles. The interesting thing was how prepared police were to deploy asymmetrical and indiscriminate force and trigger events that they could manipulate, and with a media class that was more than happy to help them smear everyone involved, it's hard to think that this was not this was exactly the thing that they wanted to do, was to put the anti-fascist movement back in the box of being the rabble-rousing mob. Previous to that, we had
It was fascinating because when IMAC happened, there was not a big enough group of people protesting for the police not to look ridiculous when they started to use some of the militarized weaponry that the Victorian government had supplied to them. Now, they call it the Allan government, but this has been going back quite a while, you know, so they've been given a whole arsenal of weaponry that are military style. And on Sunday, they actually used rubber bullets on people and then had the gall to stand up in front of a press conference and hold up a rock and say, oh, they hit us with rocks, which I'll have to say, in my experience, I've never seen anybody at any of the rallies throw rocks at cops.
Regardless of whether or not rocks were thrown, which, I mean, what's a rock to a gun?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what really happened is that police shot tear gas canisters and flashbangs next to a reporter's leg and cut open their leg, so much so that they had to go get hospital treatment afterwards. There's video footage of cans being tear canister cans and smoke and flashbang canisters being thrown, being launched right at people's legs. So with the intent to create panic and physical harm.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an outrage that the police can stand there. There's amazing footage of the police standing there with their cans
of OC
spray. Just indiscriminately hitting it, you know, spreading it across everybody. But the beauty of it was that the people brought umbrellas.
Yeah, they were much scorned by the umbrellas, so much so that when they picked people that were frustrating them, they pulled off their masks and sprayed about 5 centimetres from people's face to ensure that they were punished for their
temerity to wear a mask, which, of course, remember, the targeting of their legislation is one of their elements was to ban people using masks. Now, of course, people who are ill are saying that that just discriminates against them, their ability to actually demonstrate their political views. But in actual fact, it also stops the police and the government from using their technology of
mass surveillance.
And also, what? Stand there and let us spray you with OC spray. How dare you defend yourself?
Yeah. And
that's
the important
outrage.
And the important thing is that the real enemy here is the police.
Yeah, the police were violent.
Is the fact that the police can call an entire city a designated area for whatever reason they like and stop and search everyone and create situations where they are unsafe towards general public and then somehow have wall to wall media coverage of them complaining. And then what happens the next day is
Before we leave that, they were, as you said, asymmetrical. They clearly targeted people who disagreed with anti-immigration racists, and then went around saying that the other guys were really well behaved.
I'll say, look, I spoke to a lot of the March for Australia people. There's a very weird group in there, and they're not nearly as political as people would like them to be.
Well, they're not.
The people who are political are the police.
Yeah.
They're the ones that are enacting political violence on regular citizens, and they're the ones that are taking regular taxpayer money to take $10,000 trips to Tasmania because they can't even be bothered to take a commercial flight like the rest of us.
Extraordinary. And as someone was pointed out, these ordinary cops get paid about $100,000 a year.
Yeah, and they're always complaining, but Sunday penalty rates are pretty good for them.
And, of course, some people like a stoush. Go on, what were you saying?
About the helicopter ride. The police commissioner I'm not sure he's the commissioner. He's a senior member of the police force got stung, using the police helicopter to cross the Bass Strait at a cost of $10,000 to the taxpayer, which he said, "Oh, we all make mistakes sometimes, and I just made a bad decision." Well, if he's been caught once, how many times has he really used the helicopter on our dime?
filthy, I say. All right, we've got a little bit of an excerpt from a speech done by Debbie Brennan, Radical Women. She was at the Homeless Persons Union's rally on the 21st outside the Melbourne City Council, which we'll be talking about later in the program. But she was talking in particular in response to what happened on the Sunday and what we should be thinking about for positive change.
Hi, it's great to see so many people here tonight and even more people for the Homeless Persons Union Speak Out. Kudos, respect, and many, many thanks to the Homeless Persons Union for holding their Speak Out, and also to the Defend Dissent Coalition for following on with this part of the Speak Out in solidarity, and also making the links between the issue of homelessness and the right to protest. I'm Debbie Brennan. I'm a member of Radical Women. Radical Women is a part of the Defend Dissent Coalition, and I'm speaking for Radical Women. The fact that we're standing on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation really strikes home. It says a lot. As both Robbie and Meg said earlier, this is the sovereign land. This is the sovereign authority, not the authority of those who stole this land. And it's very telling that we are being subjected to the power, the armed power of the Victorian government and the state through their police and, well, eventually their security guards, when they have no authority to do so. The state government and the Melbourne City Council, they don't want gatherings like this. People have already said they don't like it because business doesn't like it, and that's more. But our growing protest over the last couple of years also scares them, because they see us organizing, us who are homeless, who are unionists. We're fighters for Aboriginal justice. We're fighters for climate justice, trans and queer justice, and for Palestine's liberation. We threaten their idea of stability and quote unquote social cohesion, which is totally dictated by the interests of profit, certainly not by ours. So they're ramping up the powers of the police and security patrols to bring us under control and to restore order. We've watched police violence intensify as our organizing has gotten stronger. So the brutality of the cops against us on Sunday was a taste of what's expected to come. And if the government bill passes, it will get a lot worse unless we stop it. Sunday also made it crystal clear whose protest rights are permissible and whose aren't. We've watched the police praise the rally of the far right and the fascists for being peaceful and cooperative and engaging with the police, and demonize the left as dangerous. Now, this speaks volumes, as we obviously know. They're saying that those who protect the capitalist status quo, which the far right and fascists do, can have the streets. Those who challenge it lose that right, and the state will use its power to come after us. We have been warned. All of us here are familiar with the police role in this system. None of us has any illusions about its neutrality, about its community consciousness and whatnot. We know their role in the system, and we expect their violence against us. But the thing is this, we have to demand, we have to stop it. We don't have to take it. We have to challenge it. Look at the Homeless Persons Union, who are in there right now demanding the rights to safety for homeless people. We need to stand together, which means that we together claim and exercise our rights to do so. In Victoria, there is no body of accountability for the police, except the police. Our movements have to demand it, and we have to organize for this. We have to call out their violence every time and challenge it, like the millions across the United States who are doing that right now. We should take a leaf from the book of the First Nations movement, which has resisted and organized relentlessly against deaths in custody. Let's join their call for police to be held accountable to our communities. In the deaths in custody movement, there's a call for elected community bodies with powers to investigate, to charge, prosecute, and punish violent police conduct. This is a demand that is immediate, it's concrete, it's logical, and it's powerful. It flips the whole narrative. And when we unite for it, we would show the collective power not seen before. So we've got our work cut out for us. What the powers that be are scared of, we should be very proud of. The last 2 years has shown us what we're capable of. So let's do it. Let's unite. Let's fight. Thank you very much.
And that was Debbie Brennan from Radical Women, who was speaking at the Speak Out for homeless people outside the Melbourne City Council before they were having a meeting around the plan that they've got to institute a $2 million plan for security guards to move on homeless people in the city.
And not only that, they also have a plan to put on the what they dub safe city, smart cameras. Nick Reese has a plan to that. We'll link to a petition in the podcast notes that you can sign. You can let Nick Reese, no cameras, no surveillance, because as my professor pointed out, you know, what are cameras really going to do to someone that's having a mental health episode? They're not going to discourage anyone from engaging in violent action. What they're going to do is surveil people. And that's what they intend to do.
That's the intention.
We were in the city the day before yesterday at the public housing meeting that was held at the Capitol Theatre to hear what was said. There was an interesting panel of 15 speakers that gave 3-minute little speeches about their specific
viewpoints.
Yeah, a lot of architects, a lot of people that had spent quite a lot of time, PhDs, research thesis, or otherwise their own time to investigate other ways to refurbish a building. And it was good that we were in the Capitol, like you were saying off the air before, that the Capitol Theatre had been refurbished, and that the benefits that it contributes to community after it's been refurbished rather than pulled down and rebuilt is way not only cost effective, but actually retains the beauty of the original building and reproposes it to a new generation. And that's something that a lot of people have spent a lot of time in regards to the public housing towers. But what can be said after that meeting is that the plan that the government is wanting to undertake, which is $5.2 billion of worth of a price tag, they're happy to pay that price tag because there's contracts in the demolition, there's contracts in the landfill, there's contracts in the every single part of that. They're not interested about the price tag. The price tag is the thing. Everything is a speculation. They got a little market for everything. So people need to act accordingly. It's important to know those numbers because they're the things that are going to sway voters. But coming out of that meeting, the real thing that needs to happen is more community organizing and more community coordination. So if you're listening to this first time, subscribe to 3CR, come in, volunteer, go out and get some audio, go out and talk to people because that's the work that needs to be done, especially as we saw this week, Albanese smiling like a little lapdog as he shook Donald Trump's hand and sold off the only bargaining power that we have as a country towards America for peanuts. Our rare earth minerals going off to America while they have still tariffs over us. You have Trump in that press conference saying, oh, well, they, being us, badly need airplanes from us and we're the only ones that can give it. Well, yeah, how about we build some?
Yeah, Australia and United States have signed a landmark critical minerals deal with both countries to contribute at least $2 billion, $3.1 billion, to rare earth projects over the next month. The framework announced on earlier this week is designed to secure a critical minerals supply chain for semiconductors and defence technology as China tightens control over global supply. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese signed the deal with US President Donald Trump at the White House, describing it as, and this is in inverted commas, really significant day for both nations.
Yeah.
It's like play school, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's funny, I gave a presentation on 3CR being one of the organizations that actively pushes back against neoliberalism as part of a uni project this week. And I showed them the little documentary, and it's funny. It says, you know, F the ABC, give the money to us. And I think what better time than to do that, because even the ABC was saying, oh, great success.
Great success. Yeah. Great success. It's interesting because it ties in with the AUKUS deal, of course. Undue Influence is an online media outlet, and it's got a rather interesting article called AUKUS, Revolving Door, Spiralling Down. Ahead of the launch of a new database on the Australian military industrial complex, we document the farce that AUKUS has become. It is clear to many that AUKUS, in particular, its early fulfilment stages, our language, it's so tied, is become a debacle. In February, Defence Minister Richard Moles lauded as a very unique tautology arrangement Australia's a gift to the United States of $4.7 billion to bolster America's struggling submarine output, highlighting that such an arrangement hasn't been seen in other defence pacts globally. Well, of course not. Who gives money to the supplier before they've supplied? Of course, such an arrangement hasn't been seen elsewhere. Most other countries wouldn't agree to hand over this massive sum without ensuring there were provisions for a refund should the promised submarines fail to arrive. In an inept performance in Senate estimates in June 2024, Vice Admiral Jonathan Meade, head of the Australian Submarine Agency, woodenly refused to answer a straightforward question from Green Senator David Shoebridge about whether the agreement Australia has struck with the US contains a clawback provision which the promised submarines failed to be supplied. It is thus obvious that Australia has no contractual way of recovering its money should the current or a future US president block the transfer of the submarines, as the US president is entitled to do under US legislation. It goes on, this article, to talk about the revolving door between politicians and their embeddedness with weapons manufacturing companies like Thales and others. So they're making policy with these begemoth corporations that create perpetual war at our expense.
Yeah, and especially chilling is in the Senate estimates. Friend of the show, Professor Emily Foley, sent me a video about the guided weapons system and explosive ordnance team releasing a cookbook that was discussed during the Senate estimates that they were all laughing about. Or was that the, is that you, Admiral, with the pizza, with the pasta maker? And they're all laughing about how in the opening lines it says food bring, we recognize that food is something that brings us together. This is the cognitive dissonance that these people are operating under when a guided weapons and explosive ordnance team can put together a cookbook and it gets talked about on our dime at the Senate estimates.
We're going to go to Voices for Palestine, Chris Hedges.
There are two types of war correspondents. The first type does not attend press conferences. They do not beg generals and politicians for interviews. They take risks from combat zones. They send back to their viewers or readers what they see, which is almost always diametrically opposed to official narratives. This first type, in every war, is a tiny minority. Then there is the second type, the incoherent blob of self-identified war correspondents who play at war. Despite what they tell editors and the public, they have no intention of putting themselves in danger. They are pleased with the Israeli ban on foreign reporters into Gaza. They plead with officials for background briefings and press conferences. They collaborate with their government minders who impose restrictions and rules that keep them out of combat. They slavishly disseminate whatever they are fed by officials, much of which is a lie, and pretend it is news. They join little jaunts arranged by the military dog and pony shows where they get to dress up and play soldier and visit outposts where everything is controlled and choreographed. The mortal enemy of these poseurs are the real war reporters, in this case, Palestinian journalists in Gaza. These reporters expose them as toadies and sycophants, discrediting nearly everything they disseminate. For this reason, the poseurs never pass up a chance to question the veracity and motives of those in the field. I watch these snakes do this repeatedly to my colleagues, Robert Fisk and John Pilger. And this is, of course, what I experienced a few moments ago. When war reporter Ben Anderson arrived at the hotel where journalists covering the war in Liberia were encamped, in his words, getting drunk at bars on expenses, having affairs and exchanging information rather than actually going out and getting information, his image of war reporters took a huge hit. I thought, finally, I'm amongst my heroes, Anderson told me. This is where I've wanted to be for years. And then me and the cameraman I was with, who knew the rebels very well, he took us out for about 3 weeks with the rebels. We came back to Monrovia. The guys in the hotel bar said, "Where have you been? We thought you'd gone home." We said, "We went out to cover the war. Isn't that our job? Isn't that what you're supposed to do?" The romantic view I had of foreign correspondents was suddenly destroyed in Liberia, he went on. I thought, actually, a lot of these guys are full of shit. They're not even willing to leave the hotel, let alone leave the safety of the capital and actually do some reporting. The dividing line, which occurred in every war I covered, defines the reporting on the genocide in Gaza. It is not a divide of professionalism or culture. Palestinian reporters expose Israeli atrocities and implode Israeli lies. The rest of the press does not. Palestinian journalists targeted and assassinated by Israel pay as many great war correspondents do with their lives, although in far greater numbers. Israel has murdered 245 journalists in Gaza by one count and more than 273 by another. The goal is to shroud the genocide in darkness. No war I covered comes close to these numbers of dead. Since October 7th, Israel has killed more journalists than the US Civil War, World Wars I and II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, including the conflicts in Cambodia and Laos, the wars in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, and the post 9/11 war in Afghanistan combined, according to an April 2025 study by Brown University. Journalists in Palestine leave wills and record videos to be read or played at their death. On a sweltering afternoon a few weeks ago, I was in the office of the head of Palestinian TV in Cairo, talking with Salman al-Bashir, who was the network's correspondent in Gaza. On the evening of November 2nd, 2023, Salman was scheduled for the evening broadcast. It was, he tells me ruefully, the 106th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, which in 1917 committed the British government to establishing, quote, a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Palestine TV reporter Mohammed Abu Khattab was concluding his six-hour shift at 7 p.m. on the grounds of Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. After reporting on the ongoing bombings and destruction, he handed broadcasting over to Salman. Abu Khattab, whose apartment was next to the hospital, went home. Most of the other journalists, because traveling any distance in Gaza was dangerous, slept in tents on the hospital grounds. There was an explosion near the hospital, Salman says on a video he shows me of his broadcast. We can hear an explosion that is very loud. Television presenter Duha Shami in Ramallah says to Salman, it sounds close. Yes, Salman says on air. There has been an explosion. I see the ambulances. I will let you know when we have any news. A member of the emergency team at the hospital runs towards Salman shouting, Mohammed Abu Khattab, Mohammed Abu Khattab, your friend, your colleague, has been martyred. They targeted the house of Abu Khattab. Salman stops. He looks into the camera and says, the target was apparently the house of Mohammed Abu Khattab's family. A lot of people have been killed. Mohammed Abu Khattab was apparently martyred. Salman stands in front of the camera wearing a blue flak jacket with the word press emblazoned on it. He is wearing a blue helmet and holds a microphone. There is no international protection at all and no immunity, he says to the camera tearfully, as the red lights of an ambulance flash behind him. These flak jackets and helmets do not protect us. They are just slogans that we wear. They do not protect journalists at all. Here we are victims losing our lives one after the other at no cost, he says, as he removes the chin strap of his helmet and takes the helmet off. We are waiting for our turn, one after another. He undoes his flak jacket, lets it drop to the ground. We can't take it anymore, he says emotionally on the camera. We're exhausted. Here we become martyrs. It is only a matter of time. No one sees us or the size of the catastrophe. No one sees the crime we are experiencing in Gaza. Psychologically, I couldn't accept it, Salman told me in Cairo. I was with him 20 minutes earlier. Now he was dead. They brought his body to the hospital. I refused to look at him. The people who saw him told me half of his face had blown away. In the video, he turns away from the camera and sobs. Duha, in Ramallah, folds her head into her hands and wipes away tears. We are victims on live television, he says in the broadcast. Mohammed Abu Khattab was here half an hour ago. He left us, along with his wife, his son, his brother, and other members of his family. Salman shows me a video of Mohammed's funeral. He is one of the pallbearers. Mohammed's body is wrapped in a white shroud. His blue flak jacket and a microphone lie on top of his body, along with a small Palestinian flag. There is no God but God, the crowd chants. The martyrs are God's beloved. Salman then shows us a video of the gutted remains of Mohammed's apartment where he and 10 family members were killed. Did you do anything differently after Mohammed was killed, I asked. I was very cautious, Salman answered. How, I asked. With my language, he said. I started speaking very professionally. I talked about the war and the details of a war without using words other journalists were using. I tried not to aggravate the Israelis. I no longer referred to them as Zionists or the new Nazis. I stopped using words like messianic. I stopped calling them the Israeli occupation army. I called them the Israeli army. Salman continued his work until his friend, the Al Jazeera cameraman, Samer Abu Dhaka, who had Belgian citizenship, was killed on December 15, 2023, in a drone strike. Samir had sent his family, including 4 children, to Belgium, but he refused to leave Gaza. He and Wa'il al-Duda, Al Jazeera's Gaza bureau chief, had been covering the aftermath of an Israeli strike that killed at least 20 people at Haifa School in Han Yunis, which was being used as a shelter for displaced families. Wa'il was wounded in his hand and stomach, but managed to escape. The Israeli soldiers and hovering drones fired on ambulances and medics attempting to reach Samir. 3 rescue workers were killed. Samir, who was 45, bled to death over 5 hours. I was with Samir on the day before he was martyred, Salman said softly. That was it. I couldn't continue. I had to leave Gaza. In August 2025, when Middle East journalist Mohammed Salama and Ahmed Abu Aziz, Reuters photojournalist Hussam al-Masri, and freelancers Mawaz Abu Taha and Mariam Daga, who had worked with several media outlets, including the Associated Press, were killed, along with 15 others at Nasser Hospital in a double-tap strike designed to kill first responders following the initial strike. How did Western news agencies respond? Israeli military says strikes on Gaza hospital targeted what it says was a Hamas camera, the Associated Press reported. IDF claims hospital strike was aimed at Hamas camera, announced CNN. Israeli army says 6 terrorists killed in Monday's strike on Gaza hospital, the AFP headline read. Initial inquiry says Hamas camera was target of Israeli strike that killed journalists, Reuters reported. Israel claims troops saw Hamas camera before deadly hospital attack, Sky News explained. For the record, the camera belonged to Reuters. The news agency said Israel was fully aware they were filming from the hospital. Al Jazeera correspondent Anas al-Sharif, one of the most popular journalists in Gaza, who reported daily on the genocide, received death threats on his phone. In November 2023, the Israeli military ordered Anas to cease reporting and leave northern Gaza. They sent him messages informing him that he was being tracked. His family home was bombed, killing his father. The Israeli military's Arabic spokesman accused him of terrorism and being a Hamas operative overseeing the launching of rockets into Israel. The Committee to Protect Journalists called the sustained attacks on Anas a precursor to assassination. The Tel Aviv-based magazine Plus972 reported that the Israeli military has a special unit called the Legitimization Cell, which carries out campaigns to portray Palestinian journalists as Hamas operatives in an effort to justify their assassination. In October 2024, Anas was with a group of journalists who were fired upon by Israeli soldiers in Jabalia. Cameraman Fadi al-Wahidi, clearly marked as a journalist in his flak jacket, was shot in the neck and paralyzed. Soon after, the Israeli military accused six journalists, including Anas, of being militants. His Instagram account was taken down. On May 2nd, 2025, after Israel blocked food and humanitarian aid, Anas reported on the mounting malnutrition and starvation in Gaza. In July, he posted on social media that he is drowning in hunger and called the starvation a slow death. In one broadcast, he choked back tears as a malnourished woman behind him fainted. A bystander shouted, "Keep going, Anas. You are our voice." On August 10th, 2025, Anas and three other journalists were killed by an Israeli drone while in their media tent outside of Shifa Hospital. How was the killing of these journalists reported by their colleagues in the Western press? "Israel kills Al Jazeera journalist it says was Hamas leader," reported Reuters titled its story, despite the fact that Anas was part of a Reuters team that had won a 2024 Pulitzer Prize. German newspaper Bild published a front page story headlined, "Terrorist disguised as a journalist killed in Gaza."
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You're with Annie and Tabea on Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, your community radio station, and we've got Spike from the Homeless Persons Union on the line. G'day, Spike. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. I'm finding it hard to hear you.
Oh, okay. I'll talk up. Can you hear me now?
Yes, it's a bit better.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Okay, the reason why we've got you here is because you were you and Kelly, as part of the Homeless Persons Union, presented the voices of people experiencing homelessness to the Melbourne City Council on the 21st as they were discussing their new plan. Can you talk to us about what happened at that meeting?
Okay, from 5:30 to about 9 o'clock Tuesday night, they were forced to listen to the submissions made by the public in relation to the security guard plan and a bunch of other issues as well, like new developments, you know, new apartment developments, that sort of stuff. So what was important to us was people speaking to the issue of the security guard policy. We were able to present 10 testimonies from people having a lived experience of homelessness in the CBD. That are having a lived experience right now. And the counsellors and the people present were able to hear the dramatic impact it had on their mental health, their physical health, their sense of self, just their self-worth, and the impact it had on their ability to conduct their lives throughout the rest of the day. They're already having to deal with having showers, do their laundry, make a meal, all within the 9 to 5 you know, 9 to 5 hours, like in between business hours. Like homelessness doesn't follow business hours, but, you know, people who are on below the poverty line benefits, you know, like we can't provide them with a service, you know, that
makes 24 hours
all day. But
yeah.
The important thing for us, I guess, now is just to remind to be able to remind those councillors the depth of the impact that that policy had on those people's lives.
Did you, I mean, as someone said out the front, that this Melbourne City Council isn't really a democratic organisation because it's overrepresented by the vote of the commercial interests at in the Melbourne CBD. And this may not even be people who live in the CBD. These are people who are running commercial outlets. They have double the presence in the voting process. Did you see any discernible interest from the councillors about your presentation?
That's a really good that's a fantastic you know what? I guess we were talking about this the other day, and it's a really like some of us thought, well, they were forced to listen, you know, and they had to act because they acted really disinterested. They had this really cold, vacant sort of look about them. And then on the other hand, I guess you could look at it, that's their way of, protecting themselves. And, I think that was a really difficult, that was really difficult to judge. I see, for a lot of us, going in there with those testimonials, we thought that was a really good idea. We thought it was about as historic in the sense that for probably the first time that they were forced to listen to the impact that their policies had on people, the people that are homeless.
Yeah, I understand.
So I guess I don't know how much your question is how much impact did it have on them.
Yeah, I mean, on their vote, I presume.
Oh, the vote. I'm sorry. I think that's set in concrete. I think go back to the issue of democracy and democratic. That's such an undemocratic body. Apparently, people who own businesses get two votes.
Yeah, they do.
In the voting when at election time and the. At the city council election, so it's completely, it's totally bogus. There's not a democratic bone in their body. So, and it has nothing. Yeah, they're not interested in democracy at all. The policy's undemocratic. There was a complete lack of consultation with the people. There was no consultation at all. There's not even consultation with the people they purport. Like the capitalist class they purport to represent, they didn't even consult with them till after the fact.
Okay.
So even though it was a representative body, there's not a representative representative bone in their body. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Apparently, Tuesday the 28th of October at 5:30 p.m. there's been a call to. Have people come because the council plan is going to be formally adopted by the council?
Correct. That's what I guess. That's like the theatre of a democratic process is that, you know, they're going to go through their processes and adopt the plan, yes, on Tuesday. And I guess we would like to have a presence there on Tuesday night also. Just to remind them that we're not going away. This isn't. I mean, we're finding this really difficult at the HPU as to like what do we do now? And I think it's important that we get together, all our allies and the people that are opposed to this policy, get together and put our heads together because it's, you know, we can't let this happen. You know, even they decided that they're going to do away with the private security guards and replace them with what they call safety officers, which makes not one scintilla of difference as far as we're concerned. It's just changing their jackets.
Yeah, yeah, it's so, like calling the weapons industry the protection industry.
Pardon? Sorry?
It's like calling the weapons manufacturers protection industry.
Correct. Yeah, 100%. So, yeah, we're encouraging people to go down there Tuesday night and, yeah, to show solidarity with people solidarity with people whose lives have been dramatically impacted by this outrageous policy. You know, the militarisation of public space, that's fundamentally what it is. Not to mention the cameras, the 100 extra private cameras that are going to be added to the existing public cameras, you know, surveillance cameras in the CBD that are run out of the town hall office. So they're going to be able to profile people, and we know from history that it's the people that are constantly being profiled and put in the faces are in the crosshairs is the homeless, but vulnerable communities, minorities. So it's important that we continue to show up and make our voices heard.
Thanks for talking to us this morning.
No worries. Thank you.
No hatred, no violence, no starvation and no greed. And no kings, no kings, no kings. No lies, no bullets, no bombs, and no need for no kings, no kings, no kings. No walls, no judgments, no oppression cowering to kings, no kings, no kings. Every color, every culture, every language, every creed, and no kings, no kings, no kings. Dying in the clutches, no more dying underneath. No kings, no kings, no kings. No more dying for the causes no one asked for, no one needs. And no kings, no kings, no kings. To all the dignity, the love that they deserve and need. No kings, no kings, no kings. The pursuit of happiness, the right to life and liberty. And no kings, no kings, no kings. No child going hungry, for there's plenty enough to eat. With no kings, no kings, no kings. May I recognize your soul, that you may see the soul in me. No kings, no kings, no kings. Close your eyes and listen, so that you may truly see. No kings, no kings, no kings. That the killing of my foe indeed destroys a part of me. No kings, no kings, no kings. No hatred, no violence, no starvation and no greed. And no kings, no kings, no kings.
A weak solidarity Bricky team listener when it started with a few thousand loyal, decent true blue Aussies who know immigrants are killing this country, stealing jobs, housing, bludging on the public purse. Good, decent true blue Aussies who waved and covered themselves in what they know is the only flag that should represent this country, the Union Jack. People who would also respect and admire and obey their caring employer. Unless they're unemployed due to those socially incohesive immigrants. Good, decent True Blue Aussies were attacked by a gang of anti-fascist terrorists. with only the brave, neutral, peace-loving, constabulary to protect them, and protect them they did. Now, I want to go to tossing a coin. If we toss it 100 times, the odds are we will get heads half or near enough to half the time and tails the other half. So we'd assume that at events like last Sunday, the odds are the coppers would face the decent, love the one true flag citizens half the time and the terrorist rabble the other half. But no, they face the terrorist rabble 100% of the time. Amazing odds. Thus, when they come to pepper spray at random and turn their paramilitary weaponry loose, it's always the way they're facing. Amazing. Amazing. Well, no, not when we think about it. Silly me. They have to protect decent citizens who just want immigrants and no proper papers, queue-jumping illegal vote people and terra nullius non-land non-people sent back to where they came from. Although the latter case may throw up a few little difficulties. As we've said a few times, we bet the terra nullius non-land non-people wish they'd had a boat people policy 237 years ago. Again, of course, the decent people's complaints are down to capitalism, yet they blame everything but. As a by the by, on that toss the coin bit, another odds phenomenon. Caring employers inadvertently underpaying their lazy avaricious workers. Odds are they should inadvertently underpay half the time and inadvertently overpay the other half. But no, underpay 100%. Again, amazing. On which caring junk food employer grilled the workers after months and months of fighting to put its 4,200 lazy avaricious workers on an agreement, ensuring they ended up with less than award rates, finally agreed to a deal ensuring they received the proper rates. After which its supremo said the Fair Work True Blue Aussie no longer looks like it, Work Choices looks like it, commission agreement, a landmark achievement. Our people are our greatest asset. We listened carefully and fought hard to deliver the best possible outcome for our teams. Good on him. Although for months and months, fighting hard for the best outcome was to rip them off even more than the normal rip-off. We expect Big Supremo Anthony Albanese will be spending this weekend scraping that thick brown coat off his tongue after a successful bow and scrape pilgrimage to the court of our new royalty. Success in this case, escaping without the king attacking you as a horrible person, a bad man. Indeed, we have to wonder why anyone would want to meet the Don, but any wonder Anthony escaped the habitual abuse as he promised trillions more of our money to subsidise the US of the UN of the US of the world train killer nuclear program and to subsidise the filthiest rich of the filthy rich True Blue Aussies and US OBS rare earths and critical minerals investments, including our very own Gina. Trillions more on top of the cheap government-backed loans she already has in her very, very deep pockets. And trillions more in the future to Donald's US of Donald economy. So why would Donald want to criticise such fawning generosity? For the time being, it's only a matter of time. For instance, last week, despite a facade for the cameras, behind the scenes, Donald excoriated Ukraine Supremo Zel Ungratefulsky and told him he had to concede lots of Ukraine to Donald's friend Vladimir, to whom Donald would delay the good news in a meeting with Vladimir in Hungary, where Vladimir was safe from being arrested as a war criminal. But this week, Vladimir was no longer his friend, and Donald imposed sanctions which may or may not be lifted next week when Vlad might well be his friend again. Although, not sure why Donald's still interested, given the conflict was resolved in January, the day after the Don ascended the throne. Meanwhile, in that other conflict he resolved day one, the ceasefire is doing pretty well by Zion standards, as they've killed lots less non-land, non-people than they normally kill. poor Zion so often forced to kill while observing ceasefires because the other party has the audacity to observe the conditions. While the panacea two-state solution, so beloved of our Zion supporters Anthony and the minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny Left Wing, took another giant step forward with the Knesset voting to annex the West Bank altogether. That is, the little bits left that it hasn't already annexed, with the US OB saying this week it wouldn't support annexation, probably until next week, and Zion Supremo Benjamin, not another Yahoo, also saying he wouldn't support it this week. Strange, seeing he supported it every other week. And as there's hardly a structure left standing in the rubble that is Gaza, that Riviera drooled over by Donald and his son-in-law, really wish the proponents of a two-state solution would tell us just where the two states should be. After yet more extrajudicial murders on the high seas, one in which two terrorists were killed, it is my great honour to destroy a very large drug-carrying submarine. Submarine, Donald, anyway. Two survivors were deported back to Ecuador and Colombia. Colombian Supremo Gustavo Petro retorting, US of government officials have committed murder and violated our sovereignty. Fisherman Alejandro Carranza had no ties to drug traffickers, prompting Donald to put him in his place with his normal restraint. He's a lunatic who's got a lot of problems, mainly mental, biggest mental problems ever, ever. Now, I raise this item just to run that past us again. Donald called another head of state a lunatic who's got a lot of problems, mainly mental. He's also added former supporter-turned-enemy John Bolton the weapons to the list of perceived opponents he's ordering be prosecuted for not liking Donald. Bolton for allegedly taking home secrets, a charge Donald would have faced if he hadn't won the election. At the same time, Donald announced he had ordered covert CIA operations to bring down the evil Venezuelan government, presumably rendering them overt. And if anyone else had made that admission, he would be charged under the appropriate Secrecy and Security Act. But of course, these things don't apply to Donald. I don't doubt warmonger John Bolton should be charged, but with war crimes over Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, I think it's important, indeed I know you're hanging out for our deep analysis of Barnicle's defection and its implications for the country, for all of us. Right. That was our deep analysis of Barnicle's defection and its implications for the country and for all of us. Although it is serious. We lost Constable Peter Duffer at the last election and now possibly Barnicle. Two walk-up starts for satire. On a positive note, Barnicle was perpendicular. Also standing, in front of the Louvre, a row of French, police blocking the entrance after that brazen jewel heist, which just may be a classic example of locking the stable door. And just thought we'd offer a word of encouragement to the caring business class party's media ubiquitous Senator James Potlimall's son. Still waiting to hear James say something we could vaguely agree with, but despite that, James, a reassurance. See, the Spencer Street, no longer Spencer Street, Falfax, now Nong, listed the caring business class party team from the moderates, so-called, to out beyond Genghis Khan. Moderates including Supremo Sussan, Lees and Dregs, and Institute of Public Very, Very Private Affairs alumni Tim Willitaxon. And given they're the moderates, a speech by James warning the party against turning left, James, we don't think you've got too much to worry about. A former senator. At Thursday night's huge meeting at the Capitol Theatre discussing public housing, or rather, lack of and demolition of same, one speaker quoted former union heavy and long-term socialist senator, bum on the plush red seats, which was the extent of the red, Doug Cameron, recently calling for the government to do lots more for public housing. And I thought, very good, Doug. But it might have helped a lot more if you had said all that when you were in Parliament. In Parliament, and doing what Anthony made him the Minister for Pollution to do, Murray Swartz, the Environment, was confident his Environmental Destruction Bill would pass with the support of the caring business class, Hayseed and Sheepshit Party's coalition. After Murray had consulted the coalition, and more importantly, the great polluters, to ensure they were happy with the legislation, making it lots faster and easier to pollute. The ideal balance between the environment and the economy, Murray explained. Observers pointing out the previous minister, Tania Plibersek, had been sacked because she failed to solve the problem because she produced a bill that would have protected the environment and which upset Western true blue Aussie socialist Supremo Roger Cook, the planet, and the great polluters who run his state. Putting the fear of the Almighty into that epitome of courage, Anthony, who ordered Tania to throw away her disgraceful attack on the polluters. Well, the great polluters and Roger and Anthony and the coalition are happy with Murray, or were, after shadowy Minister Angie Bell Tolls for the Environment said she was previously optimistic, cautiously optimistic, because Murray had listened to her and made sure there was no climate trigger, which has upset the Greens no end. The current draft strikes the right balance for industry and the environment, Angie said, and we know how much that lot so care about the environment. But Thursday, her Supremo and would-be big Supremo Sussan attacked the bill as putting a handbrake on investment. Oh no, Murray, you might have to work on that balance a bit more. As the Hayseed and Sheepshits Kevin hoed down the forest scan screen, they did not protect but destroy the forest industry, coming up with a novel argument for turning the chainsaws loose. When you shut down a national park, weeds grow there and koalas leave because they can't get around the ground. Direct quote, he really said that. We can be sure that's based on deep scientific analysis. And what a lovely man. He really cares about the dear little koalas. Oh, and finally, Murray is establishing a federal environment protection authority, but the minister, that is Murray for the time being, will have the power to overrule it if it does something anti-true blue Aussie, like reject the pollution proposal in favour of the environment part of Murray's balance, allowing Murray to get the balance right. Anthony must be so proud of him. Good morning.
And thank you very much, Kevin.
Good morning, Kevin.
Yeah, that's right. You're with Annie and Tobiah on Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, your community radio station. And we've got Don Sutherland on the line. G'day, Don. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Annie. And g'day to you and all your listeners. I hope things are really less windy than what they've been, less gaelish, let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's right. People were knocked off Frankston Pier with that wind. Implication of critical minerals agreement. That's what you want to talk about.
Yeah, well, I do want to talk about it, especially because we're approaching the 50th anniversary of the coup against the Whitlam Labor government in 1975, in which the United States State Department played a big role in reinforcing the processes and the rationale for the coup. Now, I don't want to go into any detail on that, but I think what we've seen in the last week or so, and which has been apparent for longer than that, is just how much Albanese Labor is on a very different pathway as a neo-Labor government to what the Whitlam government was in terms of its ability to manipulate, as it thinks it's doing, its relationship with the United States. So we should, I do want to talk about it for that reason, and also because of the connection to AUKUS. What we're seeing is this on display, is this tension between national sovereignty and Australia as a client state. And the tension very much is that there are really big, serious question marks about whether this new agreement on critical minerals is really going to advance our national sovereignty. And you can see that in you know, the government's own statements, you know, even Richard Marles back in 2023, really, in essence, it had some very good phrases in it about national sovereignty, but it boiled down to a conception of everything about China is bad and everything about the USA is good. So it's a very fluid concept. If before we understand the agreement, there are two things, background reminders we have to keep clear in our head as we look at the agreement. Firstly, both countries, Australia and the USA, are not getting any effective economic recovery. It's modest and fragile. It's staggering along. And that is a very big difference to how capitalism is supposed to operate. If it has a downturn, then it has an upturn. Well, that's not happening. It's a stagger. There's no really solid growth that comes out of it. Secondly, the climate change is continuing to get worse. Climate heating is continuing to get worse. And in that context, sitting in behind this agreement are the negotiations going on between the government and various parliamentary forces about a new Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. And this has very serious implications for how quickly and how favourably approvals for transnational corporations to explore and develop mines can proceed. That's what it's all about, setting up a new regime for the most powerful corporations to intensify and speed up their appropriation of country. Mm. And that leads to the final preliminary point, is that in all of the commentary I've seen about this new deal, there has not been a single reference, and I've looked fairly widely, to the role and rights of Aboriginal people in making decisions about any rare earth development. Because rare earth development, by its definition, is poisonous, and it will do damage to the country. And there, once upon a time, we were under the impression that a Labor government thought that the rights of Aboriginal people on such decision-making were pretty important, but it does not figure at all, even in their own public commentary. So that's the background to when we look at the agreement. Now, the agreement itself is available online if you Google it, and it's worth reading. It doesn't take long, only about 5 or 6 minutes. And
you mean it's like a cut to the neck?
Yeah. There's the agreement and then the White House fact sheet that goes with it, if you can get such a thing as a fact out of the White House. Quite hilariously, the other day I made a comment and I accidentally said the Shite House, and I thought, well, okay, that's probably a typo I'll rock and roll with. fact sheet. It tells you a little bit, and then it tells you a lot more, for example, about what the intentions of the Trump administration.
In relation to that little slip, I did one with the environment monster instead of the environment minister.
He may well turn out to be like that. The fundamental assumption in this agreement is that, keeping in mind that the mining industry corporations that are interested in critical minerals and the rare earths component of them have been active in Australia for some time, but the industry is in a downturn for various reasons, some of their own making and some a product of just how capitalism works. So it's an industry in the doldrum. It's a bit all over the place at the moment. And the second assumption is that there aren't enough profits that have been appropriated by those corporations for productive investment of their own initiative. problem is that profitability early enough and substantial enough is not there. And so guess what they do in the face of all of their claims to be the opposite? They ask for a government handout. That's what's going on here.
Wow.
And both states, both the Australian and the US government, are loyally working out how to help the profit-taking private corporations who can't see the profitability to do it of their own initiative.
Unbelievable.
So that's what's going on there. As I said, these corporations, both domestic and foreign, have known about critical mineral resources in Australia for a long time. It's not new knowledge. And the real issue here is how China's more profound and serious grasp of how to develop new industry is so powerful, because it is profound, about doing it in a different way. This means they now have leapt far ahead and, in essence, control the industry globally, not just in mining, but in development from smelting through to commodity production. So Western capitalism, this is a classic example of Western capitalism trying to play catch-up and survive relative to whatever you might call the Chinese alternative.
So where does that place us? We're not the corporations, and we're not even the government. What about us in this picture?
There's two or three levels to that in that question. The first one, I think, is in stark relief in the ABC's report about the response of the little community of Waruna near Wagerup, south of Perth, at 120 k's south of Perth, on Thursday. They reported the condemning views of local people about the implications of the gallium in that part of the investment within the existing or associated with the existing declining Alcoa operations in that region. And they are well on top. There is a real tension between parts of the community already. Those who are now conditioned to think it's a good thing, and then there are those who are seeing all sorts of problems, especially the environmental ones, and they don't just apply to people who are conscious of their environmentalism, but also to businesses, particularly the winemaking industry in the area. So that's how it pans out. The potential overriding of the proper protections for socially useful development. Now, so that's how it pans out for us. What about the broader community, the broader Australian majority? For the volume of investment required, this will not make much of a difference, if any at all, to employment prospects. Keeping in mind that right now, unemployment is rising. This agreement is not going to reverse that. There might be other things that can be done to reverse it, but not this. So this is an agreement for the big end of town in the mining sector, and that's why the Minerals Council of Australia now love a Labor government. They recognise that this Labor government is far more competent than the Liberals in advancing the interests of the mining corporations. And they say that at their website. They don't say the word competent, but they're in full praise of everything that Labor's doing And that's because Labor is confident at getting them what they want.
Yep, that's right.
There are two projects. There's that Gallium project in Wagerup, and there's another one owned by a corporation called Arafura in the Northern Territory.
That's right, yep.
Now, my hunch is that there is going to be a big discussion amongst Aboriginal people about how that unfolds. And I'm not privileged to know anything about that. But the Australian government's already put up $840 million into it. And that company is part-owned by Gina Rinehart.
Yep. There you go.
So what they're talking about, to make that one work, is even more public investment. Now, there is some suggestion that there'll be some government ownership on both sides, reflective of the investment, but don't know very much about how that will work. At this stage, you can't find that in either the official statement or in the White House fact sheet or anything that Tim Ayres or...
So really what you're saying is that it smells of corporate welfare.
Well, I would go further and say it is corporate welfare.
Yeah, righto. Okay.
And, you know... If
so really, say, really, there's really nothing in it for us, is there? Or the country?
It's tricky because a lot of the minerals will be important in socially useful technologies in the future. That is not the direction in which this is headed. Trump, for example, the whole of the Trump edifice, not just Trump, but the whole edifice.
The oligarchs.
They do not agree that climate change is a thing. So the purpose of this agreement, from their point of view, is to advance war making and to enable the big car companies in the USA to compete with the development of auto technologies in China.
So they're big brains, they're big thinkers.
Yes. They are big thinkers in ways that we are not, to our detriment. And it is corporate welfare and it's not socially useful. There might be some spin-off in Australia, but it would be a spin-off, it's not conditional, and there's hardly any detail to be able to say anything except ask serious questions about whether it's not its true intention to lead to socially useful technologies that help to slow down global climate heating and reverse it. That's not going to happen.
We need to finish up. I'll have to say that we really thank you for your analysis of this. Have you got some final words you want to put to this subject?
Yes. This is a very big deal for those of us who are socialists to the left of the Labor Party and the Greens. Our continued irrelevance is founded on our fragmentation. We will not be able to deal with the strategic implications and the problems this deal is going to create for Australia's working class majority, 85% of the population thereabouts, unless we deliberately stop thinking that each one of us, whether it's an organisation or individual, are the only ones who know the only true way. We've got to stop thinking like that and find big steps forward and urgently for a common program around which we can develop a common struggle.
Well, all right. You've put us all on notice.
Mighty task that we'll all have to get to.
Yeah, and it's every single one of us, including me, I have to look at the way I go about things. So I'm off to a Tasmanian socialist gathering in Launceston this afternoon. It's something that I haven't done for a while. We all have to change. We have to all look at building and helping each other take steps towards an alliance, a coalition of some type that can be, instead of at the margins, largely irrelevant in terms of momentum, with honourable efforts all over the place, but largely irrelevant, and really start to make a difference.
Thanks for talking to us this morning.
The rising tide thing, I reckon.
Yeah.
It's going to be a big opportunity for collective study of this issue and what to do about it in a better way.
Thanks for talking to us this morning, Don.
All the best, everybody. See you soon.
Avanti o popolo, alla riscossa.
Radio File presenta
the inaugural Gaetano Greco Memorial Symposium on Gramsci's Contemporary Relevance.
Hegemony, Resistance and the Modern Condition.
Interpreting Current Global Crisis through Antonio Gramsci.
Tuesday, 11th November, 6:30 p.m. Solidarity Hall. $20 waged, $15 unwaged.
Speakers include Dr. Cole McNaughton, Zach Gillies-Palmer and Dr. Elizabeth Humphreys.
Celebrate the legacy of our comrade Gaetano Greco and learn about Gramsci.
The event will be recorded on 3CR,
your anti-fascist
community radio.
Remember to tune in to Radio Filef every Wednesday at 6:30 p.m.
Non siate indifferenti, ci vediamo lì.
Yeah, well, there you go. You can put that in your calendar. Fantastic speakers and a great philosopher. So there you go. Before we go, just a couple of reminders. At 11 a.m., there's going to be a gathering outside the State Library, corner of Swanston and Latrobe Street, today. It's in support of No War in Latin America, as the Americans are banging their drums with illegal attacks on Venezuela and other countries in that region. There's Alan Jose Art Award for Young Women, 25th of October to the 14th of December is the exhibition. But today, opening event at 2 to 4pm at Bayside Gallery, Brighton Town Hall. And our very own Dr. Joe Toscano is going to do the welcome.
And today, just if you didn't have enough options to go to, Free Palestine Melbourne is also holding a campaign strategy day at the AMWU building, 251 Queensbury Street, Carlton South, on how to translate international obligations into concrete actions. So if you've been waiting in the wings, wondering what the union movement's doing and wondering how you can help, get down and register online. Right? It's 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. today. Make sure your voice is heard.
Which song out of this great selection are we going to be playing?
We'll go out with Akaba by Dutch Nazari.
Which one's that?
The top one.
Okay, there we go.
Till next week.
Asia Pacific Currents up next.
Ricordo ancora i tetti di ogni casa, l'odore forte dell'umidità. Alla mattina gocce di rugiada sulle colline accanto ad Aqaba. Il traffico e il rumore in ogni strada, profumo di tabacco e di caffè. E quella voce dolce che cantava, cosa diceva, me lo hai detto te. Cantava, il mio amore ha la pelle di un'oliva e prega tutti i giorni là di tenerla viva e lotta per la libertà, perché da quella riva fino al mare che c'è là la gente torni libera. E sai che il mio amore ha tre occhi clandestini ed un profumo di villa e di gelsomini, e prega un po' più forte là per i suoi bambini e per la loro libertà.
Quanto costa restare qua? Difficile restare umani. Dimmi cos'è normale, dimmi cos'è l'umanità. La vedi che tu crolla, sbriciolarsi tra le mani.
La normalità, tutti familiari, averne familiarità. Bombe sopra gli ospedali con impunità. Senza cibo, senza acqua, né elettricità. Propaganda a mezzo stampa come scamotage. Mentre qua ci si domanda come stiamo Taz. Guarda quel bambino morto in braccio a suo papà. Il dolore che una mamma ha. E ora prova a domandarle se condanna Hamas.
Quanto costa restare? Quanto costa restare qua? Difficile restare. Difficile restare umani. Dimmi cos'è normale. Dimmi cos'è l'umanità. La vedi come scompare. Scivola via dalle mani.
Quanto è buono questo pane quando c'è.
Quanto è buio questo buio quando è notte. Quanto fa paura l'osservare il cielo sperando rimanga buio tra le tapparelle rotte. Tu sei questa gente è te. E vi lega un filo che non si rompe. Perché un filo di speranza quando c'è è in grado di rendere sopportabile anche la morte.
Intanto dentro al cuore una canzone suona forte.
Il mio amore ha la pelle di un'oliva e prega tutti i giorni Allah di tenerla viva e lotta per la libertà. Perché da quella riva fino al mare che c'è là, tra l'ente dormi libera e sai che il mio amore ha tre occhi clandestini ed un profumo di lilla e di gelsomini e prega un po' più forte Allah. Per i suoi bambini e per la loro libertà, Adami Falastini.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.